In the summer of 2017, I went to visit Roanoke City School Superintendent Rita Bishop at her office. I walked in, and the first thing I noticed was a stack of at least 6 copies of J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy on her desk. I asked why she had all those books, and she told me that she'd given copies to all of her principals ahead of the upcoming school year. Vance's book is a quasi-memoir about an Appalachian expatriate family living in Ohio, regularly visiting their folks back in Kentucky. He takes that memoir foundation and broadens it to make sweeping generalizations about Appalachia and people from Appalachia. After Donald Trump won in 2016, a lot of people, especially on the left, gravitated to the book. An economic development director told me at one point, it explains Trump. Bullshit. Hillbilly Elegy is fine as a memoir, but whenever Vance generalizes away from his personal experience, he pretty quickly crosses the line into what is at best a misunderstanding of the region, and more likely a mix of ignorance, misinformation, and bad takes. He writes off things like therapy by saying he just didn't care for it. No actual facts, he just didn't like it, so it's not even to be taken seriously as a real step for people with broken family histories. And that's not even taking into account Vance's history with Charles Murray, a conservative social scientist whose work is flavored with the remnants of eugenics and who's argued that blacks and Latinos don't have the intelligence or moral superiority to compete with whites. So why was this school superintendent in the largest urban area in Western Virginia giving copies of this book to her principals? Well, first, the Hillbilly Elegy backlash really hadn't yet hit the mainstream. Public historian Elizabeth Catt pretty well knocked it down with her book, What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, but that book wasn't published until earlier this year. A number of good pieces criticizing Hillbilly Elegy had been written by folks like Elizabeth Catt, like Bob Hutton from the University of Tennessee, and Sarah Jones, who grew up in Bristol and now writes from New York for publications like New York Mag, The New Republic. I doubt Rita Bishop had run across any of those pieces, though. I did send her a few links after our interview. This is the reason that Rita was giving Hillbilly Elegy to her principals. Page 226. At least 3 times in our interview, she mentioned page 226 by name, as well as its discussion of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, A-C-E. That page includes several examples, such as being humiliated by parents, being physically abused, having separated or divorced parents, and living with an alcoholic or drug user. To this list, Bishop scribbled a bunch more in the margins. Things she'd personally seen affect her students. Homicide, worrying about food, eating only cheap food, lack of dental care. So what does this have to do with today's episode? Well, people like Rita Bishop, who work on the front lines fighting poverty, are starting to pay more and more attention to the role of childhood trauma in problems that come later in life. The ACEs concept comes up in the interview we're airing today, which is with Teresa Gardner Tyson, executive director of the Health Wagon. Based in one of the most economically distressed parts of Virginia, the Health Wagon is a mobile clinic that serves 6 counties in Southwest Virginia's coal fields. Serving the most vulnerable individuals in the mountainous terrain of Southwest Virginia takes imagination and a lot of creativity, and you see that manifest in the Health Wagon. In the early 80s, the Health Wagon's founder, Sister Bernie Kenny, drove around dispensing health care from the back of a Volkswagen Beetle. The organization then partnered with Stan Brock's Remote Area Medical to give out free dental, vision, and medical treatment to thousands of people at the Wise County Fairgrounds. That event regularly attracts national and international media coverage, in part because of its stark imagery. People camped out to get in line the night before, folks receiving dental services and livestock stalls at the county fairgrounds. You know, for some people in the region, that's sort of their one trip to do healthcare every year. A few years ago, the Health Wagon also worked with researchers from Virginia Tech at the Ram Clinic in Wise to test drone delivery of medicine. It's always worked at sort of the ragged cutting edge of innovation in delivering mountain healthcare. So that's what we're talking about here today on Blue Ridge Free State, a podcast about the politics, culture, and history of Appalachia. I'm your host, Mason Adams. I'm coming to you from my car, as usual, parked today on the side of 460 in Shawlsville. You may hear some cars in the background, the occasional train. I wrote about the Health Wagon earlier this year for a story in Belt magazine. The piece looked at how Medicaid expansion was finally passed in Virginia this year after years of Republicans blocking it. The General Assembly passed a budget bill that included an expansion of Medicaid to cover people making up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That should cover an estimated 400,000 people here in Virginia alone. Enrollment started on November 1st, and Medicaid expansion takes effect on January 1st, 2019. What allowed that Medicaid expansion to finally pass? In 2017, Democrats came within a single disputed vote of winning a 50-50 split in the Virginia House of Delegates. The Republican delegate in the far southwest corner of Virginia, Terry Kilgore, easily won re-election, but he faced his first opponent in a decade. Kilgore is a smart guy. He sees the writing on the wall and how Virginia's demographics have changed. And he knew that this next state election, which takes place in 2019, in which all 100 seats in the House and 40 seats in the Senate are up for grabs, is a big deal. The parties that control the House after that election will get to draw legislative districts after the 2020 census. Kilgore could also look at his district and see problems. The schools in Lee County are literally crumbling. The regional economy has taken a huge hit from the coal industry's wave of bankruptcies and general collapse. The opioid epidemic has hit the district hard. And although people in the district don't necessarily like Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act, they do like individual parts of it quite a bit. And that would include things like coverage of pre-existing conditions, as well as Medicaid expansion. So that's a big part of why Kilgore and a handful of other Appalachian Republicans broke with party ranks and partnered with Democrats to expand Medicaid. It didn't hurt that the coal tax credit got extended as part of the budget package either. So that's why I initially reached out to Teresa Tyson at the Health Wagon, and that's why I was visiting her at the clinic in Wise on the Monday before Thanksgiving. I wanted to find out how the clinic was reacting to Medicaid expansion. But we talked about a lot more before I left. One thing about this interview, when you hear it, and that's that I was taking notes on my computer for a lot of it. So I've tried hard to reduce that sound in the audio, but you can still hear it through a lot of the interview. If you wonder what the ticky-tacky sound in the background is, that's me typing. Okay, with that, here's Teresa Tyson Gardner at the Innovative Health Wagon Free Clinic in Southwest Virginia.
Sister Bernie Keeney, she started the Health Wagon over 38 years. Wow. 1983. Okay. And so she had come to the area at the request of the Richmond Catholic Diocese to do because, you know, the inherent poverty that was in the area. So, you know, with the philosophy of the Catholic Church, with acts of kindness in the realms of social justice and social ministry, they responded with Sister Bernie. She was a midwife in Tanzania, and she came here in the mountains and actually literally started dispensing health care out of the back of the Volkswagen Beetle, and hence the name of the Health Wagon. And then someone donated her a mobile unit, and then, you know, really the mobile health was born. And so we're essentially a free and charitable clinic here, you know, in the mountains of Appalachia. We're the only safety net clinic, you know, in this region. So we had nearly 15,000 patient encounters last year. And so we're medical home to over 4,000 patients that otherwise would not have access to health care. And so we are essentially, you know, we've got two stationary clinics, one here in Wise, we've got one in Clintwood, and then we go out into the community, and that is our larger geographic footprint with the mobile health. And so we go into six of the surrounding counties here, and these are some of the poorest counties in the nation, because as you know, Virginia is is a very wealthy state.
Yes.
But there's so extremes in the healthcare disparities, and you know, a lot of that is based on access. Our friend Augie Wallemeyer, he wrote a really good book, The Extremes of Virginia, and he kind of takes note of that you've got, you know, there's really like two Virginias here. I mean, yep. you know, you've got Fairfax County, which is the richest county in the nation, and then you've got, you know, some of the most poorest counties in the nation as well. So there's just two very extremes, and that shouldn't be. We see people dying without access to health care on a, you know, I mean, really on a daily basis. If we're not here, well, we have them come here, and I mean, sometimes we get them too late. I mean, you know, we were featured on the 60 Minutes, and for those patients, have to from lack of access to healthcare. We get them too late. We get them too far downstream. We get them, you know, when the diabetes is taking a toll on their eyes and their kidneys, you know, and the vascular system and things like that. Of the young man that was featured on there, you know, that was in his 20s. I mean, sometimes we just get them too far downstream, and all we can do is just hope and pray for the best. A lot of praying goes on here.
Yeah, I remember. So not all of your you all don't just serve uninsured folks, although you have some, but you also have folks who just either don't have access to other services, maybe can't afford to go.
Right, because we're medically underserved
there. Even if they have insurance. And then you also help people, you not only have stuff like I heard someone talking about their knee when they come in pain, but also you help people manage long-term conditions like asthma, diabetes,
the focus of this clinic, unfortunately, is chronic disease management. We see hypertension, diabetes, COPD, mental health issues, coronary artery disease, the COPD, like the asthma, the bronchitis, the co-monitors, pneumoconiosis, or black lung. We are kidney disease. We're so far downstream, like on the chronic disease management. But here at this clinic, too, we also have a very big preventative component, because we know that we can do this chronic disease, you know, day in, day out. But at some point, we've got to get upstream. And one of the recent focuses of the Health Wagon has been on the ACEs score and what happens in adverse. And that is amazing. It's called Adverse Childhood Experiences.
Oh, yeah. ACEs. Gotcha.
Yeah. So we think because our people here in the mountains, they live 20 years less than counterparts on the Eastern Shore. We think, is it what people are experiencing, you know, from the chronic poverty and all that the chronic poverty, you know, has brought with it, you know, when you look at, you know, substance abuse and, you know, the mental health issues and incarceration and, you know, all the social things that go with that. Are we looking at like the perfect storm where this is the reason that our people are living less, because, you know, their DNA has been, you know, changed by what they went through in childhood. And right. So we've got to start building resilience in our youth.
School superintendent in Roanoke City was last year giving out copies of Hillbilly Elegy, which has some problematic issues, but she could drop the page number that had J.D. Vance talking about the ACEs, because that was what she was talking about with their, you know, so she's using a book about Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah,
to give to her principles to think about Roanoke City.
What did you say? I just bought that. I just bought that in an airport. I was trapped in an airport.
I have a lot of friends who really don't like it, for various reasons. Some of the politics in it, but the ACE page is kind of near the end. He lists a bunch of ACEs, and that was something that really caught that school superintendent's attention in Roanoke City.
We think that that's where we need to be at, is building resilience in these. In our youth. And see, my score is like a 7, you know, and my brother, I mean, we had trauma in our family too, you know. I mean, our parents were like young, they were young when they got married, you know, they were like 15 and they were kids having kids, you know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so we had a lot of trauma. So my ACEs is like a 7 and it's really worrisome. So, I mean, you know, but I think if we know, you know, that knowledge is power, we can do something about it. So that's what we want to, you know, give to our community here, is we've got to start building resilience. So we've already formed some teams with Radford and the school systems here, that so that we can get into the school systems here and do everything that we can to wrap our arms around some of these children that need, you know, help with the resilience
piece. I wanted to go back because you were talking about some of the services you provide. Those are like the allergies and asthma, diabetes, mental health. Those are things that in many communities, like those are specialists.
Oh, yeah.
What's that environment like here? Because I know, for example, for mental health, like I've heard child psychiatrists in particular are practically non-existent in this part of the state.
Exactly.
What about those are there specialists for those things, or do you all feel that gap?
You wouldn't believe what we feel the gap on. I mean, Paula and I, we are doing, I mean, and this is the only way that I know, I mean, and I know there's not enough of us to go around, but this way that Paula and I look at it, we're faced with lack of specialists. And so our only resource is like, we're going to be hopping on at 1 o'clock and probably going to about 7 or 8 o'clock tonight with doing colposcopies. That is a procedure that is typically reserved for your, you know, OBGYNs when they have an abnormal pap smear. Well, we never could find nobody to get. We were always a big, you know, Sister Bernie being from, you know, the maternal background environment anyway, we've always did a lot of women's health. Well, we found the abnormal pap smears. And then we couldn't find anybody to do, you know, we could not find anybody to do the colposcopy, the biopsy of the cervix. So guess what? We had to go to UVA. Thank God we've got a wonderful partner with the University of Virginia Health System. So we went there. And learned to train to do colposcopies. That is, you know, that's a procedure that's kind of reserved. I mean, like you're saying, as a specialist. Again, we have low rates of bladder cancer here. We know that, but there's high rates of smoking. Those two don't mesh. If you've got a high population with a lot of smokers, you've got a lot of bladder cancer in there. The people not able to have the cystoscopy, and that's where they put a light into the bladder. We're doing the first. We are doing the first in the world, and I think this brings in the world over telehealth with Dr. Tracy Crespi at the University of Virginia Health Systems. We're very innovative. We've had to get, but I think that is, I mean, that is the, for all the negative stereotypes that persist about Appalachian people, the one thing is we are very resourceful. And I thank God for my Appalachian history, because I have to get resourceful and I have to think outside the box. I can't think, as traditionally as you know, what we have in the past, if we're ever going to, you know, move the needle on healthcare disparities here. So Paul and I, we've learned to do cystoscopies. We've learned to do our own colposcopies. We network. We have unprecedented collaboration. We network with so many specialists. We had three specialists that were here week before last. Remember Richmond? So it was a dermatologist, an endocrinologist, and a urologist. And so we have to get very creative and get the resources here. We do more telehealth than anybody in the state of Virginia. We did the first FAA drone delivery in the United States. Right. Our drone is going to be into the Smithsonian, because we're going to have to get resourceful how to get care out to these people. And if it's by drone, then that's what we need to be doing. I mean, because we've got to create the resources here. But God has blessed us with lots of other people that are like-minded and want to provide us, you know, with the resources here, you know, that will work with us in tandem to provide resources here. There, but I went to a funeral of a 28-year-old that was you know, we weren't doing colposcopies at that time, and she did not know the healthcare, you know, of the health wagon at that time. But I attended the funeral. She died at 28 of a cervical cancer. She had gotten at 18, lost her health insurance, got out of the healthcare system, presented when she came back in with severe, you know, pelvic pain, stage 4. At that time, she was diagnosed with stage 4. Cervical cancer, and died at 28. She'd never gotten a chance to get married or had children or anything like that. Her dad stood up and I'll get emotional, but he said that how he prayed for her to die. It's so easy to go in here and do a colposcopy this morning and take those abnormal. It's so treatable. We know that HPV now causes cervical cancer. We know that. And get them in for a colposcopy. That's what drove us to do colposcopies. We feel we have to do everything. If there's one negative thing about me, I can't say no to a resource for these patients. And I overwhelm this clinic on a daily basis. It's like fighting fire to get through this clinic every day, because we've got so many patients that are coming in, and I'm asking and really demanding so much of the staff to step up and do something. But we feel like we're in a silo here. We feel like we've been isolated from the rest of Virginia. We feel like we don't have the resources that we need to turn in, you know, to start turning. You know, we want to make this a better environment. I mean, you know, in our community, but it's got to start with healthcare, because, you know, you can't have volunteers if they, you know, if they're sick. They can't go and volunteer at the local food bank. They can't volunteer, you know, at the school and stuff like that if they're sick themselves. I mean, the healthcare of the community is the underpinning of anything. I mean, of everything here. And we've got to look at the healthcare, and we've got to make this a healthier place here in Appalachia. So that's what we're about. But as nurse practitioners, we feel that we're very good about that. We're nurse practitioner managed clinic here. And so I think with that is very positive, because, you know, typically, not to be sexist, but most nurse managers, they're women, and we you know, we get that, and we have to be resourceful, and we have to multitask, and, you know, we have to do demanding things, and we have to do them quickly and with, you know, great passion. So I think that is the positive thing about having a nurse, you know, the nurse managed clinic.
Would you say most of your patients are women too?
The majority are women, but we've got a high prevalence of men too. It's probably about 60-40. I mean, you know, because we've got everybody here needing health care. And like I said, we take care of the uninsured. But yeah, there's also with no insurance. But we also large portions of the population are underinsured. I mean, you know, we've got teachers; they've got $3,000 deductibles. Teachers in our school system here, they've got $3,000 deductibles per individual. Well, you get a couple of kids sick, you don't have $6,000 to do. To give up. I mean, people are just struggling to meet ends meet, you know, and teachers, they don't make a great income anyway. I mean, $6,000 is like, you know, so we've always taken it case by case here to the health wagon. So we will have, you know, we've got some that have maybe have Medicaid, but we're a medically underserved area. And so there's no other place for them to go. And Sister Bernie would not want anybody turned away, you know. And so, you know, we have them with Medicare sometimes. But they can't make the high deductibles. They can't make the co-pays. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and things like that. So we're here for everybody.
I know that Virginia expanded Medicaid. That was the one we talked previously. Virginia, and that goes into effect in January. They're doing mm-hmm. enrollment now. Mm-hmm. How have you all changed your model? Or broken out a separate program? Like, tell me how you're
addressing that. We have named. I have to look up the name for you. We're going ahead and at our last board meeting, we knew. I mean, you know, 7 years ago, we were looking for when we thought that they were going to expand Medicaid. You know, possibly look at a model. So at that time, we did pro forma analysis, and we looked, you know, should we stay a free clinic? You know, is there like a hybrid approach that we could do? You know, could we become a rural health clinic? Could we become FQHC and FQHC lookalike? So we kind of did that analysis. You know, possibly the rural health clinic might be a model. We will never give up our free, you know, our free clinic. We will remain a free clinic, but we're thinking about augmenting another entity to go under the umbrella of the health wagon, and that would be a model where we could, you know, bill Medicaid. Because I mean, we from every day, every morning and every night that I wake up and lay down, I'm always worried about the funding here. I mean, we won't know till we get into it, but it could be more of a burden on our small staff clinic to do it than, you know, but we're going to try it because we always need that sustainability. We're getting ready to add one, possibly two full-time staff to enroll people in Medicaid, because we do have we do have the population that's going to benefit from Medicaid expansion. So we're actually interviewing right now, you know, here in a few minutes. We've already did one interview this morning, getting ready to do a second interview. But right now, you know, our plans are we continue to see the Medicaid patients that are coming to us, you know, help them get enrolled in Medicaid, and maybe we could, you know, we'll have like a sister clinic that they could go to. I have been told that a lot of people were looking at this region. They've seen the remote area medical health expedition that we did for 19 years. And, you know, we've been inviting all the politicians down here for at least the last 5 years with the help of Augie Wallemeyer. He was a pro bono lobbyist that helped us. And we remain, you know, neutral. We're neither Democrat or Republican, but I know that our patient population would benefit from Medicaid expansion. So, but we want more so the, you know, the politicians to come here and see people lining up a week in advance for health care, to see mm-hmm. people standing in line and, you know, and passing out in line and having to be transported to the emergency room, to the ER, because they were so sick. The sickest people have never been able to come to RAM and stand in the line in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted them to come and see how we're having to bring in the Army. We brought in the Army last year. For 2 weeks, they were with us doing free dental, eye, medical, and veterinarian services. So we want to invite our politician to see what we see on a first-hand basis, you know, and then, you know, I mean, go back and vote with that in mind. I mean, with the suffering that we're seeing, and don't turn a blind eye, you know, to Central Appalachia anymore. I mean, you know, with our Virginia politician, don't go back and harm the people here. They're good people. I mean, the best people in the world are here in Southwest Virginia. They're hard working. I mean, they're devoted to their family and their community and their churches and things like that. Wonderful, wonderful people. They don't deserve what they're experiencing here with the lack of resources here. The The success of this nation was built on the reserves of these coal reserves that were here, and it's been an extractive economy. And we just, you know, we're trying to bring, you know, Paul and I, we go speak, and we speak, you know, at national conferences and things like that, to bring awareness to what we are faced with here, you know, in Central Appalachia, because we feel that we've gotten a forgotten population here. And so we try to bring awareness, you know, to that and be a proponent to help our people here.
Can I know you've got, we're probably running short on time, but I have two more questions. One is, can you just talk briefly about Stan Rock? Because you talked about the remote area clinic, mm-hmm. and I know yeah. you alluded to WISE a few mm-hmm. times, and that was just a small piece of what mm-hmm. they did nationally.
Mm-hmm.
But he died this past year, of mm-hmm. course, as you know. So can you talk about what he did for the region? You talked mm-hmm. a little bit about Sir Stephanie. Can you mm-hmm. talk about Stan?
He's just my hero, and to me, it was the greatest humanitarian that I have ever known, and he was just awesome. And what he did for the people here in the region. I mean, we closed in. We were just shy, you know, of 100,000 people that we had treated through the years, over the 19 years, and millions of dollars of, you know, free care and very conservative numbers. And then we're blessed here with, you know, bringing people to the remote area medical, and then wanting to come back another time of the year and things like that. So we've tried to coin the term medical tourism to remote volunteers, because we live in a very beautiful region of Virginia, and we want to promote that, and you know, that helps with the economy and things like that. But people come, you know, just like the three doctors that were here week before last. I mean, you know, like, they heard us speak and they wanted to come and, you know, get involved. And sometimes they want to come back, you know, more than one time a year, because they're passionate about helping others too. So we're really growing our medical tourism component here. We're really growing volunteers here, not just medical volunteers, but lay volunteers. It's a wonderful place for people to come and give back, because we have needs right here in this, you know, in the United States of America. You don't, you know, I think with me, you know, like my mom, she always wanted to be a missionary, you know, somewhere in Africa and things like that. But I think I inherited that from her. But lo and behold, I found missionary work right here, you know, in my backyard with my own people.
Where did you grow up?
In Coburn, which is, yeah, like, you know, 10 minutes from here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul and I, we've graduated four times together. Our high school, we've been best friends since we were 14. Our bachelor's is from East Tennessee State. Our master's of nursing is from University of Kentucky, and our doctorate's from University of Alabama. So, I mean, we feel that we found missionary work right here. I mean, we always came back.
Yeah, yeah.
We left, but we came. We're like a boomerang. We just came back.
Wow, that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's amazing to me. I've been thinking a lot about place-based journalism and trying to serve my region through my work a lot.
Lately. Yeah. And where are you from?
I'm from Clifton Forge.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a few hours mm-hmm. north, but
We go through Clifton Forge when we have conferences at Homestead. Yeah.
Yeah, my mom's family's been up there since the 1800s, and she lives right on the
beautiful
Allegheny. So her family's land. She moved back to her family's land now after I left for college, basically, and so she lives between Covington and Hot Springs on 220.
Now, have you've been this far before? Have you been down to Lake County?
Oh yeah, no, I've been down here numerous times. I used to cover politics for the Roanoke Times, so
yeah.
I was coming down here during Boucher's race against Griffith in 2010.
Yeah, Beth Macy spoke at a conference day before yesterday that we were at.
Yeah, I covered Obama in 2008 in Bristol, although I didn't follow him up to Castlewood. I know he came up to Castlewood and met with the UMWA later. So I've been,
you know, that was right before, that was right before, it was that in like July, because we heard that he was going to come to Ram. We were like on notice. Did you hear any of that?
This was right after the Democratic National Convention, like, because mm-hmm. Bristol was the first place he went after he was officially nominated, and he went to Bristol.
Went to Castlewood.
And he went to Castlewood to meet with the UMWA.
Yeah, I think I remember.
That was before the coal workers completely soured National Democrats. Can I ask you just real quick, and I hadn't thought about asking this, but you kind of mentioned, you alluded to it, but you talked about you and Sister Bernie kind of helping bring Ram that first time.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that came together and
yeah,
how it happened?
We were invited down to participate. We went down and took our mobile unit down to Mountain City to do women's health. And so, you know, I can just remember one of the first patients that I did there. Well, first of all, I was just completely amazed at what Stan's thinking outside the box. I mean, you know, having all this health care in an airport hangar, you know, this is some radical, innovative thinking. I mean, who would even think about that, you know, to fly in, like, his plane with all this dental equipment and set it up inside an airport hangar and things like that. So I told Sister Bernie then, I was like, Sister Bernie, we have got to do this in Wise County, because I had called him and spoke to him before on the phone about, because my patients, they would come and they would have dental abscesses and things like that, and I give them antibiotics, and, you know, 3 weeks later, they're back for the same thing again, you know, and you say, you know, get that tooth pulled. Well, they didn't have no way to get the tooth pulled. You know, they weren't never going to have a way to get the tooth pulled. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, Bernie, we've got to do this back home, you know. And so I just, you know, at that event, I started going up and talking about how do you do this? You know, what do you have to do, you know, to do this and things like that. And so I was just, you know, blown away by that radical thinking about having health care in a different place outside of a clinic, you know, or, you know, we were certainly doing mobile health at that time, but it was just a radical way of thinking, and that just really meshed with Bernie's radical, innovative ideas about taking health care out into the community, because she was forward thinking. I mean, she was thinking outside the box, too. I mean, you know, we've got to, you know, if we do things the same way that we've always done, we're going to get the same results, so we've got to change things up and do things like we've never did them before. I mean, to move the needle here on these healthcare disparities. So it was really, and Stan said yes, and so I went to work planning on it. And I remember, you know, that was 20 some years ago, or 21 years ago. And, you know, at that time, I can remember standing up in front of my first crowd trying to organize all these people, you know, and I put them at table. I remember I met at the Catholic church down there in Norton. They had like a place where you meet and eat and stuff like that, and a kitchen area and stuff like that. So we gave everybody some food and spoke to the group. And I was, you know, I was so scared. I didn't know if this was going to work or not, you know. And so we placed everybody, like, I was like, you know, okay, everybody get on. Like, there's housing committee, there's a food committee, you know, there's grounds committee, you know, there's a medical committee. I did, you know, I invited everybody up in the committees. And I did that for so many years. But now it's just, you know, it's just seamless. We've been doing it for so many years. But I organized everybody in committees those first years, because there were just so many moving components of it. And I'm very competitive by nature. And so if that's going to do it, I wanted it to be the very best, and I wanted to have the absolute best numbers that Stan had ever had, you know. Yeah. And so I did, and you know, and so we, you know, we it's always been his largest medical outreach that he's ever has ever done. Now we've leveled off now to, we'll see, about 25, you know, 3,000 patients through the gate that weekend. But you know, because that's all we can park out there. If we probably had a bigger facility, we could do more. But we're trying to, you know, add different times of the year things and stuff like that. But God has blessed us with so many wonderful partners. And that is the beauty about Appalachian people, too. I mean, they want to help another person. And I think this is a reason ours has been so successful. Because, you know, some of them, you do see some of the Rams. They'll have them there for a couple of years, and then, you know, they don't have them anymore and things like that. But, I mean, here, you know, we have the longest run and remote area medical too. And it's because I think the characteristics of the Appalachian people is that we are there to help our neighbors. We have got our neighbors back, and our, you know, in our community and things like that. That's just what is so strong and important to us, and I think that's the reason it's so successful.
That's it for the interview with Teresa Tyson from the Health Wagon. Thank you for listening. Blue Ridge Free State is written, edited, and produced by Mason Adams. That's me. Music by Pomac, Twilight Fauna, and Stations. You can find me and my journalism on Twitter at Mason Adams, MasonAtoms, like the atomic particle. You can also follow and like the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Ridge Free. If you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, please rate and review. And of course, if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend about it. If you're interested in reading more, check out our website, BlueRidgeFreeState.com. I'll include a link on the show page to the Health Wagon's website, as well as to a couple of stories I mentioned earlier, including the Belt Magazine piece about Medicaid expansion and a Scalawag Magazine story about poverty and prosperity in Roanoke. That's the one that had me visiting Rita Bishop when I noticed her stack of hillbilly elegy books. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time here on Blue Ridge Free State.
Yeah, listen. I'm almost heaven, West Jamaica. True is a mountain shining down the river. All my friends there pulling on those reeds, younger than the mountain, blowing like a bee. Come to